This is Dyslexic Design Thinking. For the past 25 years, Gil Gershoni has been the head of his own branding agency, Gershoni Creative. And one of the things he's passionate about rebranding is his dyslexia. In this series, Gil sits down with members of the dyslexic community for eye-opening conversations about the intersection of dyslexia and creativity, and what dyslexia can teach us about ourselves and the world around us. Today, Gil talks to Sarah Fenske-Bahat, the CEO of the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts in San Francisco and a 2022 Presidential Leadership Scholar. Enjoy.
Welcome, Sarah.
Hi, how you doing?
It's great to have you today. For listeners who are outside San Francisco, tell us a little bit about the center and what you guys do.
Sure. Yerba Buena Center for the Arts is in the middle of downtown San Francisco. We are across the street from the city's major convention center. So if you've come for a conference, chances are you've walked by. We're between that and the city's Museum of Modern Art, the Contemporary Jewish Museum, several other cultural institutions downtown. We have lots of hotels around us. And we are a really unique institution in that we are interdisciplinary. So we have performing arts and we have visual arts. It's pretty unusual to have both of those things in a single institution. There's not that many of us. We were founded 30 years ago in a sort of great brokered compromise related to the development that occurred around our buildings. And our commitment is to program our buildings in a way that honors local, national, and international artists and connects them to the audiences of and coming to the Bay Area. We do that in a pretty specific way. We're looking to really reflect the current experience, like the moment experience. We don't really look too far backwards, although we do like to look forwards. And so we are presenting work that is primarily pretty fresh and new and inviting audience into kind of conversations about what we might learn together, who we might become together, and approaching our work with that in mind.
Wonderful. How did you first get involved in the center?
I actually started at YBCA as a fellow. I was at California College of the Arts. I was faculty, and I was invited into a conversation. They created a few fellows classes in the mid-20-teens. I was invited into one called Can We Design Freedom? And I was working on economic freedom at the time. I'm an economist at an art school, does that. There's a lot of reasons for that, which we might get into today. But I was invited into this cohort. I think it was 30 or 40 of us, either creatives or creatively inclined people who had this remit over 6 months to address this question in whatever ways we wanted to, that culminated with an exhibition. And so YBCA is responsible in my story for giving me the first opportunity to put a representation of my work into art form and hosted that in its building, which is a great honor for me. It made me want to do more with the organization. I like the people who come through YBCA and the way it makes me feel. It's one of the most diverse rooms of people I've experienced in the Bay Area. And that's really important to me in terms of finding community with people that I don't run into every day. And I got more involved, joined the board. I became the chair of the board at the beginning of 2020 during the pandemic. And I stepped into the CEO seat after our long-term leader had left. So I've now been in that role for about a year and 4 months.
Wow.
I joke that I've had almost all the jobs in the place. Like, I've sat in many of the seats. It's true for a lot of our staff too.
I love that. It is an interesting moment for the arts. You know, we've been through the pandemic, as you just said, as you joined the organization right in the middle of it. We're having a long overdue conversation about diversity and equality. What's some of the big challenges that you guys are facing when it comes to the arts?
I mean, our institution might be a little bit different than the arts in general. So maybe I'll speak about us first. Mm-hmm. Our challenge is that San Francisco was shut down for so long that turning back on with the changed circumstances downtown by necessity looks different than it did before. So when we were shut down, we decided to develop programs that would work with the financial livelihoods of artists looking to secure work for them. And we began a guaranteed income program. We started an artist-led giving circle. We're deploying state grant money to artists. And this hypothesis of artists being the best people in their communities to help those communities change became the majority of what we did. So for us, the challenge is actually returning to our core responsibility, which is programming our buildings in a very different circumstance, while trying to weave through some of that economic justice work into our ongoing operations. How does that show up in the building might be a question we would ask ourselves. So that's all challenging. Obviously, foundations are really interested in that economic justice work and have moved away from funding organizations that do exhibitions and performances without that in it. I would say the bigger challenge is relearning under different circumstances how we want to operate, right? Like, people are in a different place than they were 5 years ago. For better, for worse, people are tired. I think people want more joy in some ways. You know, I reflect that just on where I was 5 years ago, and it feels maybe less weary. And so the ways in which we're choosing what we're doing are changing, and the ways in which we do those things are changing, and our funding for those are changing too. So that's our answer. I think situationally, downtown SF plays a really big role in how we're looking at that differently. I think it's easy to look at the version of the downtown story that feels like downtown is empty. In my opinion, and I worked in Lower Manhattan after 9/11, I have a different opinion, which is that having something scaled back to its sort of core essence, right? With the thing that's going to exist in a neighborhood, regardless of whether conferences are happening, employees are going, is really an opportunity. And every neighborhood I've ever lived in that's felt like it's challenged in that way has benefited from the arts. So in a way, no matter how long the conversation about downtown and the recovery of downtown take, I feel really good about the role for the arts. And from that perspective, I am endeavoring to lead this organization in a way where we can be patient with that, where we can work with other cultural institutions, and where we play a role in reconceptualizing what downtown can be. Many, many foundations are going through a rethink on how they think. And so that part feels a little bit harder. And, you know, the part that I find really interesting, just having lived in different parts of the country and the world, I love that what YBCA does is intended to be reflective of the community in which it exists, in the community in which it serves. And for even visitors, you should get a feel for San Francisco because you come through our spaces. And to me, there's a piece of that that I think could work in any place. In education, we call that the affirmative work on the walls, right? The things that you see that you made next to all the other things that everybody else made that help you know that your experience was real. And so I'm just really interested in, are the things that we're learning and doing in these really compressed, interesting circumstances that are uniquely facing the Bay in a kind of future-looking way that, you know, I worry would affect other places too? What can we learn about ourselves? And are any of those lessons portable to other institutions in other places?
I love that you're seeing the downtown in San Francisco, and obviously where the buildings are and the community is an opportunity for reinvention. What are those opportunities that you guys are taking action near and far?
Well, so I was just at a really interesting conference a couple of weeks ago that I haven't stopped thinking about since. So the thing I'm like currently working on, workshopping it next Monday. Montreal created this quartier de spectacle, this quarter of spectacular, kind of quarter of fun. And they did that in a neighborhood that had formerly been the red light district. It didn't exist 20 years ago. And it's an area that connects different parts of the city. And what they've done is they've created public plazas that they program. They connect existing institutions via those plazas. And they're creating an outdoor destination of sorts that's fun. It's 24 hours. It's meant to be all ages. And I really loved that. I took a million photos of like all the little touches of that. But what I love is that they have this square kilometer neighborhood where they are very intentionally trying to create connection. And all the institutions in that square kilometer are invited into that conversation, right? And so to me, if we maybe worry about what's going on within our walls, but also become concerned with what's going on in our neighborhood and work with other institutions to try to activate that together, I think that's really interesting. And I think that's the kind of movement that would benefit our downtown. And so we're working on that, starting with, you know, the unit of one, while also trying to engage with our neighborhood partners to expand that unit over time and really paint a picture for, you know, the people thinking about this at the city level, how that could grow and where that might go, how expensive it is, how we pay for it, all that sort of stuff.
prior to working for Yerba Buena, you were the chair for the MBA program in design and strategy at the California College of the Arts. First of all, that sounds fascinating, and I kind of wish I was taking that course. But tell me a little bit about the program and your role in it, and how did that come about?
I think you're catching on to a storyline for me that you didn't explicitly ask me. I started there as a fellow too. And I moved to California in 2007. I had just gotten married. I had finished a stint as a banker, which I knew was not for me. It did pay off my student loans, so I have gratitude for that. But I looked around at my colleagues and I knew that that's not what I wanted to do with my entire life. And so I moved to California. My husband got a job here. I felt like I had a clean slate. And I went to see a former colleague of mine who had moved here around the same time. And he was like, you got to figure out how to process what was all wrong for you in banking. And I didn't actually know. And so I decided to go to design school. I began as a fellow in this program. A colleague of mine had told me about it. And it did help me with some new tools of understanding, figure out what it was about banking that was making me so nuts and why it didn't work for me. That resulted in me trying to start something in the technology space, learning that I didn't really like the technology space, and sort of purging that frustration, if you will. Like, I tried to work it out. I learned that actually building technology was not fun for me at all. I knew that the idea was good, and I needed a different way to process that idea. And so when we talk about the YBCA fellowship, these things, like, kind of, that was my second try at how might I process this idea? Maybe it would happen creatively. I knew I had things to say. I just needed to figure out how to do that at the time. So I started as a fellow. I think the fellows program at the time was 30 or so people. We had all done other things. It was not like we had homework or anything. It was more, I don't know, a way to compare ideas and learn different skills. It's a 9-month program. At the end of that program, the MBA program, which was, you know, kind of related, but younger people, they needed somebody to teach economics. And I have a graduate degree in economics. And I said to them, you know, I don't want to teach a normal economics program, but I'm really interested in developing a curriculum that people would actually find useful. I went to graduate school in economics and I never used any of it, ever. And the dyslexic economist joke is real. Like, I had to work really hard to learn how to do those things. And like, after 5 p.m., I don't get the numbers in the right order. Like, it's actually very confusing for me. And so they agreed to let me construct my own curriculum where all I would do is pull the most salient sort of practical methods of analysis I could for young people, really a love letter to, like, what are the most important things you need to know that are going to be useful for you over the course of a career. So I did that for several years. There was a departing chair and they asked me if I would take on the chair role, which is how I ended up with the role there. Very parallel experiences.
I'm fascinated with the idea that you were in the banking sector and then you move into, obviously, the arts. As a dyslexic, what drew you to the world of math or to the world of banking? Like, you know.
So my dad's an accountant and my mom is an artist. My mom's family are definitely people who made things with their hands. Mm-hmm. And I loved art as a child. I had amazing, amazing teachers. And I was also really good at math. And at a certain point, I'm the first person in my family who went to college the way that, you know, we think most of the time kids go to college now, like a 4-year college right after high school. And my dad had been the only other person in my family who had properly gone to college, but he had gone to night school. Like, I remember going to night school with him as a small child. And I grew up in a generation where it's like, you do the predictable thing. You do not have the leeway to go do all those other things that are never going to pay you. Part of my parents' divorce agreement, they agreed to pay for state school only. So I only applied to the state schools in the states where they lived. They lived in different states. I got into both. And I really had, in my college experience, I always worked to make the money to pay for anything extra other than school and where I lived. And I wanted to not have a ton of loans. Like, I wanted predictability in my life. That mattered a lot to me. And so I listened to the people who told me how I would go about getting that stability. And so that led me to study political science and economics and business and how those things relate to one another, and ultimately led me to New York.
Last year, you were named Presidential Leadership Scholar. First of all, congratulations.
Thank you.
Second, what is it and how did it come about?
Presidential Leadership Scholars is a program run by former presidents' staffs, and so primarily by the Bush and Clinton foundations, but in partnership with several other presidential foundations, not the Trump Foundation, if there is one, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. And their goal is every year they select, I think, 60 leaders. I believe we were their eighth class of leaders. So there might be 500 of us at this point. And they're looking for people across political ideologies, across the country, different industries, who want to make positive change, lasting change in their communities, who like really want to be put to service for the future of the country. For me, that was it's an application process. You apply, you're nominated, they check up on you in some way. I'm sure we all have FBI reports on us at this point because we spent so much time with former presidents and their staff. But it was a 6-month experience where we rotated between presidential libraries, met with their teams, and talked about what they thought made them successful. And we heard stories. Really funny stories in some cases from people I didn't know that I would admire, who have different political ideologies than me. Just to be clear, nobody from the Trump administration is included in this. So I'm talking a more lightweight version of different ideologies than mine, but including the team, right? Like I didn't know that I would find 59 close colleagues with whom I would be thinking about the future of the country, right? Who I am on a text string with, hundreds of messages every day, sharing, questioning, asking, and going through it together. It was really good for me. I actually learned that my predecessor at YBCA was leaving the same day that I learned I was invited into this program. I was sitting in the backyard of my board chair when I got both pieces of news. And for me, it was all of that and almost first 6 months of my tenure at YBCA were informed by this masterclass of leadership, operating at a super high level, very difficult circumstances. And it gave me a network with whom to process some things that you don't actually get to process with your team. And, you know, for me, I will be forever be grateful that they were with me, especially during this period, although I can't recommend it highly enough to others who care about those things. And maybe who, I think the most valuable thing actually is I was looking for hope. I was looking for hope from people who are not in my bubble. And I found it. And that changes things.
Were you able to meet any former presidents?
Yes. We spent a lot of time with President Clinton and President Bush. We also met with President Obama's staff. The elder President Bush is no longer with us. And so we met with his staff. We also met with the LBJ family and spent time with his staff. So I think the presidential libraries that we've spent time at were Clinton, Bush, LBJ, and I'm forgetting somebody, and we were at the Obama Library with the Obama team, learning about what they were building in Chicago last October. And now we are part of this wider network of people. You know, we meet monthly. It's an incredible community of humans. I can't recommend it highly enough.
Amazing. So inspiring. I want to go a little bit to the beginning for a moment. How old were you when you were diagnosed with dyslexia?
I was 18.
So late. Wow.
Yeah.
For some people, yeah. And what was the circumstance?
I was diagnosed my freshman year of college. Yeah.
And how did that come about?
What was the circumstances? Yeah. I spent my freshman year at the University of Texas at Austin. I went to high school in Houston. And so that was in the storyline of the home state school, that was a familiar place to me. It was not a new place. I had always gotten pretty good grades. I didn't have to try very hard to get pretty good grades. And when I was in a new environment, I think I placed out of math, but I was taking chemistry. And so I was, you know, in a circumstance where I had to do math, if you will. And like, I'm talking paper. This was not in Excel at that time. It was still like taking notes in a notebook and all that stuff. I remember going to a print shop to get these huge books full of things. And I couldn't make sense of what I was seeing at all. I really, really struggled with looking at, I think it was like organic chemistry equations. I've sort of blocked it out, to be honest. I don't even know that I would recognize them right now. And I went to the learning center and I really was like, this has never happened to me before. And in hindsight, there were things I should have noticed. But at the time, I was like, I've never struggled like this with anything academically. which is not to say I was good at everything, just to be clear, but I really couldn't make sense of it. And they're like, okay, well, we can give you some, like, we can walk you through and see what's going on. Like, we don't know if it's a health thing or a learning thing or whatever. And that's how I figured it out. And yeah, I was shocked. Like, so many things made sense to me after that. But in that moment, I really had a, you know, at the time, what felt like a crisis that led me to ask for help. And I found it.
What was the thing that made sort of clicked after you realized you were dyslexic?
I was always really bad at reading comprehension in standardized tests or even just like tests at school. And what would happen to me, and really this still happens to me, just if I'm being honest, it's not like my brain changed. I couldn't pick an answer. I could imagine, first of all, I had to read things several times and I had a really hard time with the clock, right? I had a hard time meeting the deadline of an exam of that kind in a way where other things were easier for me. Like, I liked the logic puzzles. I liked sort of the simile stuff, but like long form reading really required a lot of me. And when I would get to the sort of questions, you know, A, B, C, D, I could convince myself that any of them worked. I really, really couldn't decide. And I remember going to my teachers and be like, I don't understand. Like, I really just truly couldn't understand it. And it's a way that I think they thought it was creativity. Maybe I didn't know how to advocate for myself. Maybe there were not resources available at that time. But once I got the diagnosis and the circumstances under which I got it, I feel like a lot of few other things clicked into place for me. And as a parent, things I hope I would see in my child earlier than going to college.
You said you asked for help and you got it. What kind of help did you get?
I mean, I went to a learning center and they helped me. I think they helped me. First of all, I dropped organic chemistry. So I can't say that I made it through organic chemistry and like that was all fine. I sort of had a moment where I'm like, yeah, maybe we should pull back from that. So that was number one. Number two, they did give me, you know, it's funny. My daughter has a really serious prescription for her glasses. And it's a similar thing to what she's been offered. Like I got things that were simplified. So like one problem per page, more space between things, and like bigger booklets from the print shop. And I quit organic chemistry like a month after I tried these things because I was like, yeah, I think it might be the chemistry. One thing at a time. And I'm pulling it apart a little bit physically. Maybe I can do it that way. And I do think that helped a little bit. But I think more importantly, it informed the ways I chose my college experience and future experiences that would allow me to learn in a way that felt more natural, better. And I don't want to say easier because I don't know that it was easy, but maybe just like a better fit. Mm-hmm. I think organic chemistry is the pits. So science was not for me.
Well, you're good in so many things, you know, it's like sometimes I'm sure I'm not going to be good at that, but there's so many things that I'm so, you know, obsessed about and passionate about. But singing is not one of them. I always wish I can sing. And my wife and my son are beautiful. I mean, they say, and we can be in the car on a road trip and they ask me to stop singing. I mean, this is how bad this is. You
so
know?
I have
and,
to tell you, we haven't talked about this. My mother would also tell me, my sister is a very good singer, like a theater singer, star of the play, the whole deal. My mother, my own mother, who I don't really think should do this, was like, you need to stop. You need to stop. Madonna, top of my lungs. Like I'm a child of the 80s. I was really belting it out. No, she's like, you have to stop. It's so embarrassing. I can't stand the sound of it. And I cry at like choir concerts because I think it's a marvel that people can do this with their bodies.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you.
I'm surprised you're not a good singer because you have a very good voice.
Well, thank you. You know, as you discovered you were 18, you were a freshman in college, where did encouragement come from during those times?
I don't know that it did. I had a challenging upbringing and I don't know that I didn't have a lot of adults in my life that sort of pushed me. You know, I look at how I am as a parent. I know, you know, people I grew up with and their parents were often, you know, go be a doctor, go be a lawyer, whatever. Mine were just like, don't be destitute, go make money. And so for me, I didn't have enough people in my life with the lived experience of like going to college and what became of that to have a lot of expectation on me. And in a way, like, I think that was probably a good thing for me in that I had a pretty open road in terms of independence. And, you know, that was good for me. I'd leaned on my teachers heavily. Like, that allowed me to advocate for myself, I think. I also leaned on my friends and their families all growing up pretty heavily. And it was through them, especially friends' parents, that I began to see an outer world beyond my experience. And in a way, I was like, I was loved and adopted by like all those families, you know, taken to dinner by them, asked questions by them. And it really expanded my worldview and what I thought was possible for me. I think later, those characters and people were replaced by older colleagues, right, who could identify something in you and promote you or give you an opportunity and things like that. And I think I developed a real, like, I love older people. I really do. I always have. And I think part of it is just, I like the patience, people who invest in a conversation with you in a non-competitive way, where they just like want to know you and look out for you a little bit. It's a very comfortable zone for me. And so I felt cheered on by those folks more than, you know, maybe the more obvious folks.
So lucky to have those, both the community when you were younger that saw you, encouraged you, care for you, and then learning from that to seek for those mentors in your life. And I'm like you, I used to always hang out with my grandfather and he would say, go play with the kids. And I'd be like, no, I want to hang out with you. And he's like, you're six, you're 10. Everybody's in the backyard throwing the ball. And I was just like, kids my age were just not interesting to me. So I would basically walk with him as he's an entrepreneur and you know, do business. And I really kind of learned hands-on his how to make relationships and how to care for them and how to show up for those relationships and build true, long-term, meaningful friendships, you know. And I love that that's where encouragement and mentorship.
I should say my grandfather was the same. I was very close to my grandfather. And I don't even know if he could read. Like, he could have easily been a dyslexic too. There were not books in their house. Like, that was not their vibe. He built his house. He worked as a machinist. Like, he worked at a brewery. I grew up in Milwaukee. But I will say, he was like the life of the neighborhood. He was the guy that everybody knew. Everyone would come over. They had a basement with a bar in it, like complete bar, like an 8-person seated thing. This is Milwaukee. It's the whole thing.
Wow.
With a pool table. He played like 8 instruments. He was like this incredible heart of a person. And I would actually like pretend to be 6 so my grandparents would take me to their house because their bubble was easy. And it was just like, I mean, I shoot pool left-handed, not like I do this all the time because of him. I'm not left-handed. But like he would, you know, put his arm around me to teach me things. I was the oldest grandchild, so I got a lot of attention. I wasn't a boy, obviously. So I learned things that maybe gender-wise wouldn't have been learned by girls in the 70s or early 80s, unless you were the first. And like I learned how to watch sports. All the rules that I know to sports are because I would just hang out with this guy. And I thought he was fun to be around. And I liked the way he moved, right? Like, they lived in an interesting community with people who, like, a very working class place. And I liked the way they treated one another.
When did you realize that dyslexia could be a positive rather than a negative?
I think it was when I was actually doing the design fellowship. It took me a while to deprogram myself from the linear way I was taught. I really bought. I can still see the diagram of left brain, right brain in my elementary school art room and like exactly what it looked like and where it was in the building, what the classroom layout was, all this stuff. And I think I separated myself that way in a way. And I did the linear thing. And the linear thing rewarded me for a while until I understood that I wasn't having fun with it, I think. And maybe like I wasn't, I don't know. Like, I don't know that. I think the debate is out on whether your career is joyful. Like, I don't know that I can solve that one today, but I knew I needed a little bit more fun in my life. I was feeling like this can't be all there is for me. And so sort of immersing myself in a creative environment gave me permission to reevaluate a lot. And I think that I'm a very spatial thinker, which I'm sure everybody says on this specific podcast, but I really, really think that way. I got through the things I studied by thinking that way. And so adding, you know, I have a friend that calls it like a creative atlas of tools to my tool belt. It gave me a way in to the same content that felt more flexible. And I felt like I could move in some of my questions, through some of my questions, big questions, in ways that worked better for me. And so in that, I think I reunited these pieces of myself in a way that does honor the sort of dyslexic mind approach and maybe characteristic. And I do have more fun. I feel more effective. I don't feel so conflicted. You know, I had this line for a while, like, I'm sick of having the right answers and not having anything to do with them. Like this linear thing, if you don't make it move. And I think the creative mind helps things move differently. You can have all the answers in the world. And if they can't go anywhere, it doesn't matter. And also, who wants to just be right all the time? Like, that's not actually the thing. Expanding my tool set while still working on some of the same core things, economic inequality, community work, culture, it's the same stuff. But with these different, I don't know, techniques, skills, perspectives that feel more expansive and maybe less cookie cutter. I don't know. I don't have to lay out PowerPoint presentations with rationales very often anymore. Now they just have pictures and I talk about them.
Last time you and I talked, we were talking about different approaches and different techniques and different ways of keeping track of our days and ideas. And I was so inspired by your scheduling notebook and this whole, you know, system that you developed for yourself. Would you share a little bit about that for us?
I'm a person who needs to draw and write, and I am not totally a technology person. Like, I can't remember things in the ways that I need to. If I'm only typing, it's not the same thing for me. So for many, many years, I had these sort of dual track things. And as I increasingly saw my calendar go into Google Calendar or Apple Calendar or whatever, I use both, I felt like there's something about the calendar that I still need in my notebook. I still need to write things down. I extremely spatially need to look at the calendar several different ways. This was exacerbated when I became a parent and came to understand that I now am tracking like six calendars for four people. Each of my and my husband's work and personal calendars and my two kids' calendar and the babysitter calendar and all these things. And I'm like, oh my God, like, what am I going to do? And so I began this, like, what am I going to do? And so what I have figured out after lots of trial and error is that there are very few notebooks with calendars where you have flexibility on how many pages you can write in between days or weeks. There are many where you can have a week or a day and sort of have a write-up of what that's going to look like. And then you are allocated and you cannot veer from this allocation, like three freaking pages for whatever duration of time it is. You feel guilty if you don't put anything in it and you don't do anything. And you are actively discouraged from like putting your full set of thoughts in there, because who can fit that on three pages? So I have solved this problem I also have a monthly and I also have a daily, but I find myself gravitating to the weekly. I have a weekly packing note sticker with blanks in it, so it can be any day. I'm not wasting any of them. If I'm on vacation, I do not do this, and I don't feel guilty for not having that week in my notebook. It's a very specific notebook too, that does, where every page is not the same. Some pages have grids, some pages have dots, some have irregular grids, some have this like lovely circle pattern. It repeats like every 10 pages. And I can handle that level of repeat as long as they're blank pages. And so now I have a sticker that I put in for the week, and then I can put all my things for the week, however many pages I want. I have full freedom. And a stack of red notebooks on the shelf behind me, right? Or in front of me. So for me, not every page is the same, which keeps my brain clicking. I don't have these weird allocations that I disagree with. And I have like my perfect school supply. It absorbs the pen, like my favorite pens well, so things don't bleed through the paper. It is like a little bit neurotic, but
I love it.
For probably 6 years, it's been the perfect tool.
So, you know, at our agency, when we're working on a branding projects, I make everybody print everything. you know, even if they do a mood board on Pinterest or whatever, I was like, print it. And in the beginning, all the designers and the strategists and the company like, what are you talking about? Like, this is hundreds of prints. And I was like, I don't care. And then I made them cut it and then tape it. And then, you know, you put it around the room and it's all whiteboards and you can then write next to it, you can move it around. It became addicting for everybody. Like, they got so excited when we needed to do it because you sit inside of the idea process, inside of the visual thinking mindset, and they get to experience being dyslexia adjacent and experience how we interact with the world around us with such a physical way.
Yeah. It's funny you say that because at the current moment, one of my projects at YBCA is we have a digital model of our spaces, right? So our preparator team and our exhibitions team and our performing arts team, they can lay things out and communicate about them. But we do not have like a scale model. Many museums have this, a scale model of our spaces that might allow us to see it like IRL. Doesn't happen. And I really struggle with that because I want almost like a weird New Yorker drawing of our buildings where we can literally print out stickers or pieces of paper, whatever, to do exactly what you describe in the sphere of looking at our spaces and what we are setting up to have adjacent in our spaces. Increasingly then outside of our spaces too, right? Like, what is the experience? And this is a way in which I think the language of design really helps me. But what is the experience design of a person coming into our spaces? What are all of the things that we need to think about when you think about the things that are like butting up against one another? What does it feel like for me or for you to walk through a building and have like some joyful discovery instead of a bunch of signs pointing in different directions and confusing you? So you're giving me a little energy for that project. I sometimes think that I'm being difficult and like losing my mind. And I forget the part about like, no, this is beneficial for many more people.
Paramount. I mean, I love the challenge of what you're saying. I mean, it makes me think of, we just recently redesigned the Schwab Learning Center, which they support primarily Stanford students with dyslexia and learning differences. And originally, they just wanted to put beautiful pieces of art by dyslexic or portraits or stories. But then we started to sort of walk through the space and started to print it and look at it and say, how do we make the space tell the story of change, of transformation? You know, how can this be not a learning center? Can this be an innovation center for dyslexics? So, you know, everybody was in the room in a space walking when we were presenting solutions. We were talking about why we're doing these things. You know, I think that there's one massive wall that we covered the whole thing with a huge TV there for content. And for most of the teachers and facility folks there, they felt that the wall was very, very busy. But then there was some of the teachers that are dyslexic. And they says, oh my God, it's not busy. It's so soothing for me because the energy of it, it matches my energy and my processing. And they all kind of start to understand the choices. Like, certain areas need to be quiet for different kind of learning styles. Certain areas need to be flexible so you can have multiple people experiencing a lecture or a community event or a performance or whatever. And when you bring everybody along like that from all the different mindsets, they actually understand the choices. And it's not just beautiful paint on the wall. It becomes part of the value and story of the space. And as we transformed it through the phases that we've done with it, you can see people coming in and just jaw-dropping because it was transforming the energy of the space more than just designing an office or a hall or whatever it is. So,
well, you're reminding me. I mean, we at YBCA did something different with one of the exhibitions we currently, you know, we're taking down this week. And what we did is, alongside the notes describing the exhibition on the wall, right, which are pretty common across cultural institutions, we have videos of the artists talking us through some similar things, right? Like, not exactly the same thing, but like a version of the thing that is just much more interactive and accessible to anyone who has a hard time reading the notes and relating to them, and for any whatever reason. And to me, that's really interesting in a few different ways, certainly from a learning perspective for my profile, but also it removes the filter for artists having their work described by others, to have them directly describe it to the people coming through the exhibition. And I just think like that, the removal of that eye, that filter, is super duper interesting in the world of culture.
So what's coming up next for you?
There's a group of people in Milwaukee in this very famous neighborhood that's like the most diverse, sort of interesting neighborhood that does a lot of community ownership stuff that's super cool in Milwaukee, called River West. It's on the west side of the Milwaukee River. But the neighborhood's called River West. And this neighborhood self-organizes a 24-hour bike ride where that's like a Burning Man 24-hour bike ride, kind of, where there is like a course that you loop through. You can relay race. It's not a competitive bike race. This is purely a celebrating a community activity where people, like, it's almost like Halloween, right? Like every house does their thing and there are pit stops and you like check off things ranging from like art projects to beers to whatever, all the things. And I'm doing it for the first year time this year, which I'm really, really excited about because to me, it's one of the most beautiful community organized sort of really activating events that I've ever heard of in a place I love.
This has been absolutely wonderful.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Sarah. For those of you who are interested in learning more about Sarah, you can follow her on Instagram at SEFB. Or you can check out her Twitter account at Sarah Fensky Bahat. For more information on Yorba Buena Center for the Arts, visit their website at ybca.org. I'm Gil Gershoni, and you've been listening to Dyslexic Design Thinking.
If you enjoyed our conversation today, be sure to subscribe to this series wherever you get your podcasts and follow along on Instagram at Dyslexic Design Thinking. You can also drop us a line at dyslexia@gershoni.com. to receive our monthly newsletter and learn about our upcoming programming. Dyslexic Design Thinking is produced by Gershoni Creative. Until next time, be well.